As an introduction, I'd like to begin with something our Holy Father, Pope Francis, said on June 20th this year in the Vatican about the importance of what we're going to be discussing, religious freedom. It provides a very helpful frame for everything we're going to examine together. There was a global scope to his remarks, of course, because he was saying it for the whole world. But his five main points about the very intense debate about religious liberty are highly relevant to what we as American Catholics are trying to fight for here. I'd like to take those five points in turn. The first is that the Holy Father indicated that the right to religious freedom is essential to our transcendent nature. If we fight against religious freedom, we're attacking who we are as men and women. He says reason recognizes in religious liberty a fundamental right of man that reflects his lofty dignity, that of being able to seek the truth and adhere to it. It recognizes in it an indispensable condition to be able to display all his potential. If the human person isn't permitted to act in accordance with a well-formed conscience, then his growth will be stunted, Pope Francis is saying, and he'll never be free. So this is far more than about particular issues. This is about human growth as a whole. If we don't have the ability to hear God in the organ of sensitivity, which we call our conscience, then we're not free, and our growth will be stunted. Just like anybody who's raised jailed would have his growth stunted. Second, religious freedom isn't merely the ability to go to St. Philip's in Greenville to pray, but it's the capacity to live in accordance with our faith. Religious freedom, he said, is not only that of thought of private worship. It's the freedom to live according to the ethical principles consequent upon the truth found, be it privately or publicly. This point that Pope Francis is making used to be obvious to everyone. But the present administration in Washington has been making a coordinated effort in both foreign and domestic policy to reduce freedom of religion to a small part of it, freedom of worship. Why would it be doing this? Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2009 was very candid with regard to foreign policy, why there was this shift from religious freedom to freedom of worship. She said that it was in order to allow people to love in the way they choose. A euphemism to describe that in order to promote the right to same-sex pseudo-marriage, we have to suppress the right to religious freedom, because every organized religion in the world recognizes that marriage is between one man and one woman. And so you can't have it both. And in order to have this novel right to same-sex marriage, we've got to suppress the right that's enshrined in the First Amendment to freedom of religion. But we've also seen it domestically. We'll talk about it a little bit later in the Hosanna Tabor case of a few years ago in Michigan, where the Obama administration's Solicitor General argued that religious institutions shouldn't have the ability to hire or fire people according to their own religious beliefs, except in the very narrow circumstances that they're actually teaching religion. So if at a Catholic school you want to have a transvestite custodian who spends all his off time going out and attacking the church as having Neanderthal ideas, that we don't have any right under the First Amendment to say that doesn't meet our job requirements. We want somebody to be walking the walk alongside of us. That's what's been occurring. And Pope Francis wants to stress that religious freedom isn't merely the ability to pray as we choose, to go to a mosque on Friday or a synagogue on Saturday or a church on Sunday, but it's to live according to the principles of our faith. Third, Pope Francis said in June that religious freedom is undermined precisely by many who trumpet tolerance and freedom. Religious liberty, he indicated, is a great challenge in the globalized world where weak thought, which basically means moral relativism, in Europe we'll call it pensiero debole, literally weak thought, this whole idea that we can't know anything for certain, so there can be no truth to guide even our heads or our hearts or our moral decisions. This weak thought lowers the general ethical level, and in the name of a false concept of tolerance, ends up by persecuting those who defend the truth about man and the ethical consequences of that anthropological idea. This weak thought includes, along with the philosophy of nothingness we call nihilism, an intellectual and moral relativism. And we've all seen in the last 20 years exactly how this process happens. It begins with a push for tolerance of what was formerly morally censured, but then ends up in an intolerance and outright persecution of those who don't progress beyond acquiescence to acceptance and then ultimately approval. It's what's happened with abortion. It's what's happened with marriage. We've got to know this pattern. The pro-abortion movement, for example, originally just asked for the freedom to choose abortion, but now is seeking to force all doctors and nurses to be trained in performing abortions, and having all citizens, including nuns and priests, and every other person with a moral objection, to pay for it. Those pushing for marriage between those of the same sex first asked just for tolerance, but now push for the resignation of those like ex-Mozilla CEO Brendan Eich, who defend marriage as the union of a man and a woman. The fourth step, Pope Francis says, is that without religious freedom, a democracy is sick, and it begins to undermine its own legitimacy. Political and judicial bodies, he insisted, are called to recognize, guarantee, and protect religious liberty, which is an intrinsically inherent right to human nature, and is also an indicator, he says, of a healthy democracy and one of the principal sources of a state's legitimacy. In our Bill of Rights, of course, the United States recognized, guaranteed, and protected religious liberty. But recent offenses against the first and fundamental freedom show that a democratic republic is not strengthening, but sickening. And that must concern all of us who love our country. Fifth and lastly, attacks against the religious freedom of Christians are not only the most common today, but the most ignored. Pope Francis said, "It's for me a reason of great sorrow to see that Christians in the world are enduring the greatest number of such discrimination against religious freedom. The persecution against Christians today is in fact stronger than in the first centuries of the church, and there are more Christian martyrs now than then. More Christians have been martyred in the last 100 years than all previous 19 centuries combined." The type of deadly persecutions he's describing are happening mainly in fundamentalist Muslim regions, like in ISIS-controlled regions of Iraq and Syria, or in the Boko Haram terrorized regions in Kenya and Nigeria. But they flow from the same denial of the right to religious freedom that is spreading like cancer in supposedly free secularist nations, where the last acceptable prejudice among elites, Christianophobia, an irrational fear of Christianity, is enabling it. If the types of school and church bombings, kidnappings, and massacres happening routinely to Christians in various parts of the world were happening to Jews, or to gays, or to women, there would justifiably be a media and international obsession about it. The fact that they've been happening unabated, while most ignore it, until the beheadings of two Americans as Americans last month, ought to be as incomprehensible, worrying, and unacceptable to all of us as Pope Francis says it is to him. It's high time for all of us, but especially us Catholics in the United States, to ponder these realities, to pray, and to get involved to help nurse our nation back to the health Pope Francis indicates. We're born at a time and a place in which Jesus, the divine physician, is calling each of us to be his emergency room trauma unit nurses. That image points to the stakes involved and the urgency of what we're being summoned to do. But if we're going to help out a patient in the field hospital in battle that Pope Francis called today's church. We not only have to treat the present wounds, but for the sake of the patient's overall health, we have to understand some of the causes of the lifestyle that has brought the patient to its present sick state. So let's get to the etiology, the background of the cancer attacking religious freedom in its various metastases. Then we can talk about the prescription needed, knowing that our living out our faith fully as committed citizens is going to be a crucial part of that medicine. To give us the background, I want to turn to Pope Emeritus Benedict's words to and about the United States of America. Back in January of 2012, in a meeting with visiting American bishops, Pope Benedict expresses alarm at the attempts being made to limit that most cherished of American freedom, the freedom of religion. He said that he was distressed that concerted efforts have been getting made to deny the right of conscientious objection on the part of Catholic individuals and institutions with regard to cooperating in intrinsically evil practices, like, for example, abortion, and that some elements were trying to reduce religious freedom to mere freedom of worship. In order to combat these worrying tendencies, the Holy Father said that there was a pressing need, buckle your seats, for an engaged, articulate, and well-formed Catholic laity, endowed with a strong critical sense vis-a-vis the dominant culture, and with the courage to counter a reductive secularism that would delegitimize the Church's participation in public debate about the issues that are determining the future of American society. So he's calling every one of us to be engaged, not to sit on the sidelines, to be articulate, and not just repeat the same old, but to be able to do it with nuances. Well-formed doesn't just mean intellectually know the ideas, but it's sunk from our heads to our heart and come out to our hands in charity, to our feet as part of the new evangelization, to our knees in prayer. Endowed with a strong critical sense vis-a-vis the dominant culture. So many Catholic lay people are awesome critics of the Church, and they'll readily point out every time Father Marr's a hypocrite in anything he says or does. But it won't turn those same crosshairs on our politicians. And with the courage to counter a reductive secularism that would delegitimize the Church's participation in public debate, need courageous, engaged, articulate, well-formed, critical Catholics. I'm very grateful that you have come today stepping forward as those Catholics. But we need to clone ourselves in a moral way. The U.S. bishops, in their excellent letter on religious liberty, released in anticipation of the first Fortnight for Freedom a couple years ago, said that as bishops we're seeking to bring the light of the gospel to our public life, but the work of politics is properly that of committed and courageous lay Catholics. We exhort them to be both engaged and articulate in insisting that as Catholics and as Americans, we do not have to choose between the two. There's an urgent need for the lay faithful in cooperation with Christians, Jews, and others to impress upon our elected representatives the importance of continued protection of religious liberty in a free society. The most articulate spokesman in the United States on religious freedom concerns, Philadelphia Archbishop Charles Chaput, has been summoning Catholic laity to awaken from a social somnolence and fulfill the vocation Christ has given to be salt, light, and leaven in society. In an interview last year with the National Catholic Register, he said, "Religious liberty as an ideal sounds lovely, but in the abstract, it has very little power. It is political force only to the degree that ordinary people believe and practice their faith and refuse to tolerate anyone or anything interfering with their faith." The current White House, he went on, has a clear track record of ignoring the traditional American understanding of religious freedom and interfering with the activity of religiously inspired organizations. If lay Catholics accept that sort of government behavior without inflicting a political cost on the officials responsible for it, then they have no one to blame but themselves when they find that their liberties have gone thin. Unless lay faithful get seriously involved, he's saying, all the bishop's efforts to protect religious freedom will be in vain. If lay people, he said, don't love their Catholic faith enough to struggle for it in the public square, nothing the bishops do will finally matter. That's why the bishops have been sounding the alarm. But as one commentator who criticized the U.S. bishops for their defense of religious freedom noted on television with joy, the 270 bishops of the United States are only 270 votes. Their leadership is only consequential if Catholic lay people love their faith enough to live by it and defend it. Otherwise, what the bishops are saying will amount in the end to a whole bunch of hot air. Let's return to 2008, last time a pope visited the United States. Pope Benedict went to the White House, and there, in the presence of President George W. Bush, he sketched out, with gratitude but also with a warning, how the U.S. has been historically in the world a beacon of freedom, particularly religious freedom and freedom of conscience. And he challenged us to live up to what we've inherited. There are many people today who in this Google age live with a memory of 13 nanoseconds. We need to know this history and to be capable of echoing it with real pride to our fellow citizens so that they know that what's happening today is un-American. It's unworthy of us. From the dawn of the Republic, Pope Benedict said, America's quest for freedom has been guided by the conviction that the principles governing political and social life are intimately linked to a moral order based on the dominion of God the Creator. The framers of this nation's founding documents drew upon this conviction when they proclaimed the obvious truth, the self-evident truth, that all men are created equal and endowed with not rights that a presidential department can take away, like Kathleen Sebelius did in her HHH mandate. Those are my words, not Pope Benedict's. When they proclaim the self-evident truth that all men are created equal and endowed with the inalienable right grounded in the laws of nature and of nature's God, the course of American history demonstrates the difficulties, struggle, and great intellectual and moral resolve which were demanded to shape a society that faithfully embodied these noble principles. In that process, which forged the soul of this nation, religious beliefs were a constant inspiration and driving force. As for example, in the struggle against slavery and in the civil rights movement. That all came from religion and the courage that flowed from an engaged, articulate laity, Catholic, Protestant, and other. The Holy Father added that throughout the centuries, America cultivated these moral virtues that has kept our country free. And that example of the past challenges us today. He said, the preservation of freedom calls for the cultivation of virtue, self-discipline, sacrifice for the common good, and a sense of responsibility toward the less fortunate. It also demands the courage to engage in civic life and to bring one's deepest beliefs and values to reasoned public debate. In a word, freedom is ever new. It's a challenge held out to each generation, and it must constantly be won over for the cause of good. Freedom isn't automatically passed on to the next generation. If we start enslaving ourselves to consumerism, our kids are going to be enslaved to their toys and their gadgets. If we're enslaved to a false notion of freedom, understood as the autonomy to do whatever we want with no responsibilities whatsoever, do we think our kids are going to grow up to become new Ben Franklins and George Washingtons? No. Freedom is a gift won anew by every generation. And if we don't pass it on and fight for it, it won't be bequeathed. Pope Benedict cited the prophetic words not of the first pope, but of the first president, George Washington, who expressed in his farewell address the conviction that religion and morality are indispensable supports for political and national prosperity. Though Washington was not a particularly religious man himself, he saw that religion and morality represent indispensable supports of political prosperity. If we don't have religion and morality flowing from a religious freedom, we are undercutting the indispensable foundations of our country, and it won't work. His successor, John Adams, had similar advice. He said, "We don't have a government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and true religion. Our Constitution is made only for a religious and moral people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other people." In other words, unless men and women, boys and girls, are formed to follow properly trained consciences, America, as an experiment in ordered liberty, won't work. Unless we know what's right and wrong, and do what's right, and refrain from what's wrong, then America will be ripped asunder. Spent a lot of time in Poland over the course of my seminary years and priesthood. And there's a Polish aphorism that I've never been able to forget, that the number of policemen you need on the outside is in inverse proportion to the number of internal policemen. Consciences in their power. If we're not really following God here, then we're never going to have enough cops to keep us from tearing each other apart. Why is Ferguson, Missouri happening? Because we've lost that attention to God throughout our culture. The third president, Thomas Jefferson, a deist, said in 1809 that the government in particular must always respect freedom of religion and the freedom of conscience that's continually at its source. He said, "No provision in our Constitution ought to be dearer to man than that which protects the rights of conscience against the enterprises of civil authority." It's the most important right of all, Jefferson said. That's what Pope Benedict was stressing when he came to our country. And he said, when the bishops visited him 4 years later in Rome, that today that consensus about the importance of religious freedom in the U.S. has eroded significantly in the face of powerful new cultural currents that are not only directly opposed to the core moral teachings of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but increasingly hostile to Christianity as such. What are these powerful new cultural currents? He called them an extreme individualism, seeking to promote notions of freedom detached from the moral truth. More specifically, a radical secularism that finds increasing expression in the political and cultural spheres. Radical secularism, which is this extreme individualism promoting freedom apart from the moral truth, is at the root of all of these attacks on religious freedom. Cardinal Francis George of Chicago said in 2009 that regardless of President Obama's attestation that he's a Christian, he's the first truly secularist president we've ever had. Somebody who takes all the main categories of his thought from secularist philosophies rather than from faith or values consistent with the Judeo-Christian faith. And he's absolutely right about that. You know, just a week ago today, Pope Benedict named his successor there in Chicago, Bishop Blaise Supich, coming from Spokane. And a lot of people were rejoicing who knew Bishop Blaise Supich, especially on the Catholic left. But there's an ignorance of what Cardinal George said a couple years ago, that he was going to die in his bed, that a successor would die in prison, and that man's successor would die martyred in the public square. So let's not be congratulating Archbishop designate Supich too soon. And it won't just happen in Chicago. Secularism, as Pope Benedict has defined it, is living etsi Deus non deretur, as if God were not a given, as if God doesn't exist. This is a practical atheism that has become, in certain places in Western Europe, and now is being tried to impose on us in America, as a new religion. In 2010, when Pope Benedict was in Scotland, he spoke about it at length. He called attention to the dictatorship of relativism that was threatening British society by obscuring, he said, the unchanging truth about man's nature, his destiny, and his ultimate good. He said that there are many who are trying to exclude religious belief from all public discourse, to privatize it, or even to paint it as a threat to equality and freedom. When religious belief is excluded, he stressed, society, even a cultured society like Britain, built on the foundation of the Christian cult or worship, will devolve into nothing more than a jungle of self-destructive and arbitrary freedom. People claiming the rights that flow from freedoms and trying to suppress other people's rights. Because ultimately it's just become an idea that my freedom should trump whatever freedom you have. He spoke with great concern precisely about this worrying tendency to reduce religious freedom to mere freedom of worship without guarantees of respect for freedom of conscience. We've already discussed a little bit where that comes from. The reduction of religious freedom to freedom of worship in order to allow for new rights. But I want to pick up on what he said with regard to no guarantees for respect for freedom of conscience. Where does that come from? Radical secularism goes hand in hand with the denial of any prerogative of conscience. Because if everyone needs to live as if God doesn't exist, you can worship Him in the closet of your house of worship on the weekend, but don't you dare bring it in the public square. If we're all supposed to live as if God doesn't exist in public, then no one can claim to be hearing or following God's voice in the inner sanctuary of his conscience in his day-to-day action. That's why, for secularists, no one can be granted exceptions to being forced to comply with their secularist agenda. Last June, the U.S. bishops, during their Fortnight for Freedom, asked all of us to focus on the freedom to serve others. Because after all, Christ calls us to serve others rather than to be served, to become good Samaritans, crossing the road to care for others, to love our neighbor as God has loved us first. Jesus didn't say that all we have to do is love God with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength, but to love our neighbor as He has loved us and loves our neighbor. That requires our living out our faith in practice. And over the course of centuries, Catholics have done that individually and institutionally. At a time when only the rich had doctors, we formed the first hospitals to care for both rich and poor, nursing people back to health or preparing them to meet the Lord. At a time when only the wealthy or noble families had access to education through tutors, we formed the first schools and open universities. We formed diaconia in the early church to care for the poor. We formed leprosaria to care for those with Hansen's disease. We established orphanages for abandoned babies and homes for unwed moms. We formed programs for immigrants to learn languages, for young girls to learn how to sew, for street children to learn trades. The Catholic Church has done so much good in serving others and improving the common good, precisely because we seek to live our faith. But that ability is what's now being restricted and threatened by these aggressive secular policies in federal and various state and local governments. There's no need to give a comprehensive list. I think you know many of them. But we can briefly mention a few. So many Catholic social service agencies have needed to get out of the adoption business because of the requirement to give kids to those in same-sex relationships, which the church doesn't believe is for the integral good of kids. In order to be involved in adoption, you need state licensing. And to acquire that license, one must refuse to discriminate against same-sex couples. And this is an issue that goes far beyond the issue of same-sex marriage or same-sex relations or same-sex couples. Imagine, for example, if a government came in and were mandating agencies that they had to give kids to active drug users. Everybody would recognize what a problem that is, that those who are involved in the business need to be able to have the liberty of judgment to be able to say, I don't think that that's good for the upbringing of kids. All the stats show that the greatest situation for the upbringing of kids is a stable home situation of a loving mother and father who are united to each other, committed to each other through marriage. Why we would be telling those who are trying to give kids a better life that they need to place kids in homes that sociological survey after survey has shown is not for their greatest good is totally against what we're about with adoption. Another example is that U.S. agencies working with sex trafficking victims, but also humanitarian assistance programs like Catholic Relief Services, will not receive any government contracts unless they agree in advance to refer people to abortion. Catholic hospitals, schools, and universities, and other institutions are being compelled to offer health care plans that pay for free chemical abortions, contraception, sterilizations, or that pay crippling fines per day per employee, or cut health care for their employees altogether. And now, as of 2 months ago, in order to participate in any federal contract, President Obama has made it dependent on not discriminating in hiring on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. He signed an executive order there too at the very beginning of July. What this means at a practical level is that if Catholic Social Services, which receives lots of money for programs for the poor, the homeless, and the disabled, wouldn't be able to continue to receive any of that assistance unless, for example, it refused to consider when a gay activist should be the main receptionist, whether a transgender transvestite situation should be totally overlooked if that person were applying to become a marriage counselor. All of these threaten our freedom to serve others while obeying God. Why is this occurring? It's because ultimately, many secularists hate the practice of religion more than they appreciate the charity that flows from religion. They would rather see Catholic schools shut, Catholic hospitals, which serve one out of every six patients in the United States, close, Catholic food pantries end their charitable work, than to have us continue that work of charity and not burn incense before their radical, secularist, anti-religion. Ultimately, the secularist project is a step-by-step attempt to put real religion out of business, because they really believe that by the fact we're practicing our faith in public, that that somehow oppresses them. Pope Benedict described this powerful new cultural current that's not only directly opposed to core moral teachings of our Judeo-Christian tradition, but increasingly hostile to Christianity as such. And that's because radical secularists think real religion is a force of evil, not good. A force for repression and violence, not freedom and peace. And we just need to acknowledge that out of the gate. Still, we got to love those who have made themselves our enemies. But we have to recognize that they have made themselves our enemies. And so the false Irenicism of just thinking everything's basically fine, we just got these tiny little eeny-weeny problems, we've got to wake up. I'd like to return once again to Archbishop Shapu's thoughts. A few years back, he went to Slovakia to support the church there after 50 years of suffering under Nazi and Soviet regimes. When he was there, he examined what happens when a society tries to order itself as if God didn't exist, and when those who believe in God fail adequately to resist this secularizing trend. He called upon Catholics in the West, in particular, to recognize the signs of the times and not be caught asleep as a dictatorship of practical atheism seeks to repudiate the Christian roots and soul of our civilization. His words, as usual, are prophetic and blunt. He began by giving the Slovakians a brief history of what helped to make the United States historically great and free, in contrast to the bloodshed that bathed many parts of Europe after the Enlightenment. What made us great? And he said it was the positive role of faith in American culture. America, he stressed, was established as a non-sectarian state, but one in which faith was expected and fostered as a prerequisite for a free society. In contrast to the opinions of the revisionist secular historians today, the founding fathers had no desire for a radically secularized public life. They had no intent to lock religion away from public affairs. On the contrary, they wanted to guarantee citizens the freedom to live their faith publicly and vigorously, and to bring their religious convictions to bear on the building of a just society. The danger today is, he continued, that in both the U.S. and in Europe, we face an aggressively secular political vision and a consumerist economic model that result in practice, if not in an explicit intent, in a new kind of state-sponsored atheism. To put it another way, the Enlightenment-derived worldview that gave rise to the great murderous ideologies of the last century remains very much alive. Its language is softer. Its intentions seem kinder. And its face is friendlier. But its underlying impulse hasn't changed. That is, the dream of building a society apart from God. He said that their vision presumes a frankly post-Christian world ruled by rationality, technology, and good social engineering. Religion has a place in this worldview, but only as an individual lifestyle accessory. People are free to worship and believe whatever they want so long as they keep their beliefs to themselves and don't presume to intrude their religious idiosyncrasy on the workings of government, the economy, or culture. Despite the rhetoric of enlightened secular tolerance, he said, government agencies in the United States now increasingly seek to dictate how Christian ministry should operate, to force them into practices that would destroy their Catholic identity. Efforts have been made to discourage or criminalize the expression of certain Catholic beliefs as hate speech. Our courts and legislatures now routinely take actions that undermine marriage and familial life, seek to scrub our public life of Christian symbolism and signs of influence. In Europe, he says, we're seeing similar trends, although marked by a more open contempt for Christianity. And he drew stark conclusions from these trends. He said, these are not actions of governments that see the Catholic Church as a valued partner in their plans for the 21st century. Quite the opposite. These events suggest an emerging systematic discrimination against the Church that now seems inevitable. Archbishop Chaput said in Slovakia that the response of believers needs to be to resist the falsities and the euphemisms, the lie of secularism, by living according to the truth that makes us free. For Christians, living within the truth, he said, means living according to Jesus Christ, proclaiming the truth of the Christian gospel not only by our words, but by our example. It means living every day and every moment from the unshakable conviction that God lives and that His love is the motive force of human history and the engine of every authentic human life. It means believing that the truths of the creed are worth suffering for and even dying for. Living within the truth also means telling the truth and calling things by their right names. And that means exposing the lies by which some men are trying to force others to live. The two main lies that are popular today, he said, is that Christianity was of relatively minor importance in the development of the West, and that Western values and institutions can be sustained without grounding in Christian principles. That relativism is an adequate civil religion and public philosophy for us in the West. Without a grounding in God or a higher truth than public consensus, he said, our democratic institutions can very easily become weapons against our own human dignity through a form of intimate violence that clothes itself in democracy, wherein the will to the power of the strong is given the force of law to kill the weak. That's what happens in abortion. That's what happens in euthanasia. That despotism of might makes right, seen, for example, when those who are older, bigger, stronger, richer take the lives of those who are smaller, weaker, younger, and more vulnerable, is where we're heading in the West today. And it needs to be resisted. Just as Slovaks resisted the totalitarianism of the Nazist and communist murder regimes. This resistance, he added, must come not just from church professionals, but from every serious believer. The whole church is called to imitate the Slovakian heroes of faith and become a believing community of resistance. Such a community, he said, will call things by their true names, really believe what we say we believe, and be willing to prove God is real by the witness of our lives in the midst of a world that's on the verge of forgetting Him. The renewal of the West depends overwhelmingly, he finished, on Christian families, parishes, and dioceses beginning to live out this faithful communal resistance to the truth. I'd like to talk about one of the most pressing of all of these religious freedom concerns, the ongoing struggle with the Obama administration over the HHS mandate flowing from the Affordable Care Act. I presume most of you already know the basics of the facts, but we can give a short little historical summary. The HHS mandate was not part of the Affordable Care Act. It just said that the Department of Health and Human Services would have the ability to determine what would be preventive services. And so, basically, the Department of Health and Human Services put together a whole bunch of people who used to work for Planned Parenthood, and they said that preventive services for women means forcing all employers, including religious ones, to cover for nothing, not just mammograms, blood pressure checks, breastfeeding support, domestic violence counseling, diabetes and STD testing and counseling, but also free access to sterilization and all contraceptives, including clearly abortifacient ones like the morning after pill, approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. HHS implicitly acknowledged that they foresaw that some groups would have objections to this. So they offered certain religious groups a conscience exemption, but only those who were nonprofit organizations whose purpose is primarily the inculcation of religious values and which primarily employs and serves those who share its religious tenets. We don't meet that definition as a church because we care for all comers. We don't employ exclusively Catholics. A lot of our social agencies, they don't have to give us a Catholic baptismal certificate as part of the job interview. We try to heed Jesus' call to serve the least of our brethren, not because they're Catholic, but because we are. To be a good Samaritan to all those who are in need, regardless of religion. The HHS invited public comment on this. We gave plenty of public comment, and then they ignored it all. Then Cardinal-designate Cardinal Dolan met with President Obama. President Obama promised, according to Cardinal Dolan, that they would make the room for all Catholic service agencies to be covered, but that isn't what then came out. And when the first so-called accommodation happened, Cardinal Dolan said, in effect, all the president is giving us is a year to figure out how to violate our consciences. Since that time, under constant political pressure, not to mention lawsuits, the Obama administration has sought to revise the mandate by extending the accommodation, by allowing religious service organizations like Catholic hospitals, school, and social service programs that objected to providing coverage for these items in their employees' health plans no longer to have to pay for them. Rather, their health insurance companies would be forced to offer them for free. But everybody saw that as a smokescreen. First, most Catholic hospitals, school systems, charities, etc., are self-insured in order to save on cost. They still won't be covered because they are the insurance agency. Second, even for those who aren't, the shift of the onus of the mandate from religious service employers to insurance companies was readily seen by objective observers as political obfuscation in an accounting trick. The Wall Street Journal editorial page remarked that insurance companies aren't going to be making donations. Drug makers are still going to charge for the pill. Doctors will still bill for reproductive treatment. The reality is, with all mandated benefits, is that these costs will be borne eventually by higher premiums. We're all going to have to pay for it. Just like there's no such thing as a totally free lunch, so there's no free tubal ligation or abortion-causing pill or contraceptive. Religious organizations will still be funding these objectionable offerings one way or the other. There have still been further revisions of that, but they've never met any of the three main objections that the U.S. bishops constantly are clarifying. The first is respect for religious liberty. To recognize that religious liberty includes church charity, not just the parish church itself, but all our social agencies. Second is that there's a huge concern about who defines religious identity and ministry. The government wants to be the ones who say what's truly religious, rather than let the religions do that for themselves. The only organizations that the administration continues to recognize as religious employers under the mandate are those nonprofits that have the primary purpose of inculcating religious values and employ and serve persons who share those religious tenets. That's not religious enough in HHS's administration estimation for those who care for the poor. And this is totally different, by the way, of what the IRS considers a religious nonprofit, and diametrically opposed to the interpretation of the Constitution expressed unanimously by the Supreme Court in its Hosanna-Tabor decision, that we do have the right to hire people who share our faith and to fire them if they're not living by the faith. You know, it was interesting when President Obama went to the National Press Breakfast 2 years ago. He said there in a speech that we can't limit our religious values to personal moments of prayer or private conversations with pastors or friends, but we need to act on the command to love your neighbor as yourself. He said that caring for the poor and those in need are values that have made our country great when we live up to them, when we don't just give lip service to them. He praised Catholic Charities and various other faith-inspired organizations for whom the biblical injunction are not just empty words. There are also deeds, saying, every single day, in different ways, so many of you are living out your faith in service to others. He clearly recognized the intrinsic connection between religious faith and charitable works. Yet, in the HHS mandate, he pretends that those who carry out charitable works based on religious faith aren't really religious employers at all. The president logically can't have it both ways, even if the media wants to give him a pass. Either he was giving lip service to living faith of the National Prayer Breakfast, or the HHS restrictions are a contradiction to his own ideas. The third point the U.S. bishops have always been stressing is that they're fighting not just for a broader exemption to the mandate for Catholic institutions, but for the mandate as a whole to be rescinded. No individual or institution, religious or otherwise, should be forced to pay for other abortion-causing pills, sterilization, or contraception, which are not preventive services, like mammograms, because children are not cancers. The conscience of secular business owners shouldn't be violated any more than the conscience of those who administer religious nonprofits. This was a right the Supreme Court recognized, at least partially, in the Hobby Lobby decision, thanks be to God, this June. But the Supreme Court decided that very narrowly. We would have wanted something greater, but it was better than nothing. There's a simple solution to this problem here, as the U.S. bishops say. It's to rescind the mandate and leave the way the things were, so that those who provide, sponsor, and purchase health coverage can make their own decisions about whether to include these procedures without the federal government imposing one answer on everyone. It's not as if people don't have access to these services today. There are many health plans that already cover them and supplemental programs for those whose policies do not. But that's something that the secularists in the HHS don't want to allow. And not everyone yet sees the fundamental violation of conscience that's involved here. And we need to help people to see it. You know, the administration and many of its abettors in the media and many others who, I think, just don't see things clearly, have been framing all of this as just a debate about contraception. I was doing a lot of media interviews at this around the time that the mandate came up, and I remember one on a secular radio program when a woman called in to say that this was all much ado about nothing, that most women use contraception in the church, you just get over it. So I asked her in response whether she, by chance, was against the death penalty. She said, yes, she was. I then asked, imagine, ma'am, that you were forced, in order to have access to health care, to have to pay for lethal injections masquerading as health care to execute those on death row. How would you feel about being forced to pay for those executions? I told her that the reason why she's not opposing the Obama administration on what they're trying to do with regard to the HHS mandate is because she's basically not opposed to morning after pill sterilization and contraception. But I told her that if the Obama administration doesn't respect the principle of religious freedom enshrined in the Constitution, if it doesn't refrain itself from compelling believers to act against their conscience with regard to these issues, then what's to stop the administration from eventually compelling her to do something against her conscience? And she admitted that she saw what the real issue was. It's not just about contraception. It's about freedom. What can be done? It's important for us that we come together and not just sort of hear about the darkness. It's very important for us to become candles bringing the light of the world into our culture. I'd like to focus on five of them. The first thing we're always called to do as Catholics is to pray. It's the most powerful thing we do. That's why you started today with Mass. We need to be praying each day. The bishops have been asking us to do that, to put out a prayer for religious freedom, that we pray for the 14 days of the annual fortnight. But I'd encourage you to pray that every day, or pray in your own words. Today, in Madrid, Spain, Blessed Alvaro del Portillo was beatified. He's the successor of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei. And Blessed Alvaro constantly talked about what St. Jose Maria had said is the principle of Christian action. He said, the first thing we do is pray. Second thing we do is mortify and sacrifice. We pray with our body. And third, very much in the third, is action. One of the reasons why we're in the present state that we are is because we haven't been praying and fasting adequately. And that's one of the reasons why we haven't been acting enough in the social sphere. And so we need to focus on that first, even though I'm not going to belabor the point. Prayer and sacrifice are the two most important parts of the response we've got to make, but they don't stop there. It does lead into action. Second, we need to be talking about the threats to religious freedom and make others aware of them. So I thank you for listening today. Please continue talking to others about what this is about. The HHS mandate, for example, is not about how many people use the pill or whether they're going to have access to it. It's about whether those who object to the use of contraception or abortion pills or sterilizations or same-sex marriage are going to be forced to pay for others to do so or to have to give up their businesses to fulfill the novel rights that others are now claiming. It's about whether there's going to be religious freedom in this country or not, whether there's going to be respect for protection of conscience, or whether we're going to allow our president or others to ignore the Constitution they have solemnly sworn to uphold and defend. If we don't hold them to that oath, why are we surprised when our politicians lie to us? They're not even going to be held accountable for their promises to God. Why do we think we can hold them accountable to their promises to us? Third, we need to contact our legislators, both those on our side and those opposed, and let them know how pressing a concern this is for us. A couple years ago, I was helping to lead a media training for young Catholics, some highly influential Catholic lay people outside of Washington, D.C. And I was told that many of the people who have been working so hard for us on our side behind the scenes, the senators and the congressmen who are really battling courageously for us, felt basically all alone. They said that they weren't getting any thanks at all. and wondering whether people are going to get involved. They were discouraged because they weren't hearing from the people who appreciated their efforts. They weren't doing exclusively, they weren't doing it primarily for votes, these guys that I'm talking about. They were doing it because their conscience said they had to do it. But they wanted to know that they weren't going to be lone rangers. A lot of the times, we've become too cynical. And we don't say thanks to those who deserve thanks. We don't say, I'm watching your every move, to those who are trying to get away with things that are totally against our civic values, not to mention our religious values. If those on our side aren't hearing from us, probably those who are leading the assault on religious freedom aren't hearing from us either. Fourth, we need to get ready for civil disobedience. In their letter on religious freedom, the bishops boldly call Catholic Americans to courageous resistance. It's a sobering thing, they wrote, to contemplate our government enacting unjust laws. An unjust law can't be obeyed. In the face of an unjust law, an accommodation is not to be sought, especially by resorting to equivocal words and deceptive practices, like, they were too charitable to note, the president has been seeking to do with the HHS mandate. In a robust, clear summons indicative of the seriousness of the issue and its consequence, they state, if we face today the prospect of unjust laws, then Catholics in America, in solidarity with our fellow citizens, must have the courage not to obey them. They stress, no American desires this, no Catholic welcomes it, but if it should fall upon us, we must discharge it as a duty of citizenship and an obligation of faith. A month ago, Pope Francis was in South Korea, and he beatified 123 new Korean martyrs. And in that talk to the young Koreans, whose the soil of whose country has been drenched in the blood of so many Korean martyrs, he asked us today, what are we willing to die for? Are we willing to be as faithful to what God is calling us to do as these Korean martyrs were in the face of brutal torture and martyrdom? We've got it so much better than they do. But some of the times we'll complain like crazy, forgetting that what we face today is much less than what the first Christians faced in the Roman Empire. So let's not exaggerate the struggles, but let's courageously go and confront them. This is little league compared to the major leagues of the martyrs. But we need to win that little league championship as a team. Fifth and lastly, we need to recognize that our vote has become far more consequential. We now have those who are called public servants who are trampling to take our religious freedom away. It's not just the president, it's many members of Congress. And up here in the most Catholic states in our country, we're electing the ones who are leading the charge against religious freedom. One of the most important questions we need to be asking of anyone running for office and requesting our vote is what they will do with respect to religious freedom. We need to ask this of those who run for president. We need to ask those of those who run for Senate and Congress. And we can't be satisfied with vague words of support for freedom. I'd urge you to recognize that if a candidate for office can't defend our religious freedom, then he really can't adequately represent us. And he should never be placed in a position where he can use the coercive power of government to violate our rights. In a free country, we ultimately get the leaders we deserve. We should never elect people who would violate our rights. We have the power to correct these abuses at the ballot box. We need to rise up and courageously use that power. In order to do that, we need to educate consciences that voting is a moral action. That when we go to vote, we express what we value most. And how we vote will be a very important criterion for the one election that really counts for each of us, in which God has that sole vote about whether we have aligned our public choices with God's will, or whether we have basically said in the way we vote, my will be done. A lot of people get uncomfortable when the church starts speaking about particulars with regard to votes, because they think that voting should be a morally autonomous zone, which there's no education of conscience necessary. People say that when they go to vote according to their conscience, that means according to their whims. It doesn't mean according to listening to God speaking in that supreme intimate tribunal, that there's been an eclipse of conscience. We need various hearing aids for us to hear God's voice better. We need His Word, we need the Catechism, we need the teaching of the Magisterium, the prayers, the lives of the saints, the wise counsels of trustworthy men and women with well-trained consciences. But the essence of voting according to a well-formed Catholic conscience means turning to the Lord and asking Him, how should I vote? So how should we vote? How does God want us to vote? Does it require reading the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas to determine what we need to do in an electoral decision? Is it hard to decipher God's values and priorities when He's asking His faithful sons and daughters? In most cases, no, it's not hard. He's the Lord of life. In a choice between a candidate who recognizes that abortion is the massacre of innocent human beings and intends to work to reduce and eliminate it, and one who celebrates abortion as a great civil right and even wants to force Catholic institutions and individuals to have to pay for it, is it complicated to figure out which candidate's values God wants us to support? Similarly, would He want us to vote for or against candidates in legislation that would give doctors the ability to help their patients commit suicide? God instituted marriage in the beginning as the union of one man and one woman, as a reflection of His own image. Would He want us to support candidates who see marriage as He does? Or those who believe that God is a homophobe? That His idea of marriage is bigoted, unconstitutional, and needs to be redefined to embrace husbandless or wifeless unions? God founded a church. He calls us to use our freedom to live our faith through acts of charity and wants us to be people who conscientiously follow His voice. Would He want us to support candidates who defend freedom of conscience and religion? For those who want to use their office to compel Catholic institutions, priests, nuns, families and businesses to pay for other people to have free chemical abortion, sterilization and contraception? The answers for those of a well-formed conscience aren't complicated. Could a Catholic ever vote for someone who supports abortion, doctor-prescribed suicide, the redefinition of marriage and attacks on freedom of religion and the rights of conscience? Only in the extremest of circumstances. When the person abhors the evils that the candidate supports and votes for the candidate for reasons that the future Pope Benedict in 2004 said would be proportionate to the gravity of those evils. What might those issues be that have to be so grave as to persuade an African American, for example, to vote for a KKK member? Or for a Jew to vote for someone who's an anti-Semite? Since Catholics need to be as against the evils mentioned as African Americans are rightly against racism and Jews are against anti-Semitism, the justification would have to be sufficient that one would feel comfortable saying to the Lord at our particular judgment, I really believed in conscience that You wanted me to support that person, despite the intrinsic evils that the candidate supported, because I believe that the evils the other candidate supported were objectively even worse. That's a very high standard indeed. Does that mean we have to vote for the other guy? No. The church in a moral conscience formation never says you must vote for this person. But we can say, in order to vote for that person, you're going to need to be able to defend that face to face with God. Some of the times we're left with the choice of the lesser of two evils. Some of the times we'll write in candidates when it seems that most of the candidates are undeserving our support. But we need to face that this is one of the most important moral decisions we make, because we haven't been making it adequately. We've gotten the leaders we've deserved. we're committing social suicide because we're not taking this seriously. It's hard to believe that a Catholic citizen of sound judgment and conscience would ever support a politician who either supported or lamely refused to act publicly according to his personal opposition to cruelty to animals or child abuse or domestic violence. If a candidate's character was such that either he or she didn't acknowledge these evils or was too weak to act according to them when it came to their public duties, would we ever give such a vitiated character a pass because we think the candidate has a better economic plan? Would you vote for Ray Rice if he had a better economic plan? Yet that is what many Catholic Americans have done with respect to abortion, which kills children in more sadistic ways than the worst of animal cruelty, constitutes the ultimate form of child abuse and domestic violence. Unfortunately, today we have to acknowledge that there are many candidates who support what God and His Church have emphatically taught as intrinsic evils. Even more unfortunate is that many Catholics reflexively vote for them. To support such candidates is to become materially complicit in the evil they do when elected. When we choose to vote for them, we're prioritizing other values, often party affiliation or financial concerns, or a candidate's likability, over fighting with God the real moral evils these candidates support. Such votes express our character, or better, our lack of character. So let's conclude. Religious liberty and freedom of conscience are not principally a privilege that the government grants us and so may take away at will and whim. They're inherent in our very humanity, hardwired into each and every one of us by our Creator, inalienable rights endowed by the Lord, not by the state, as the national heroes who signed the Declaration of Independence distinguished. We return to what Pope Benedict XVI said at the White House 6 years ago. The preservation of freedom demands the courage to engage in civic life and to bring one's deepest beliefs and values to reason public debate. In a word, freedom is ever new. It's a challenge held out to each generation, and it must constantly be won over for the cause of good. This is the challenge to our generation now. May God help all of us who are dedicated to the common good, to genuine public service, rise up together to meet that challenge in defense of life, liberty, and the family. May we, with Pope Francis, recognize that this defense of religious freedom is essential to ensuring our transcendent nature. Praise be Jesus Christ.